Welcome to the Jessica Jones Rewind. We are discussing episodes 9 through 13 of season 1 today. I make that sound much more academic than it probably actually is going to be. I'm your host, Aline Sims, and today I am joined by Mr. Micah Sargent. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you, Aline. Thank you so much.
Justin Michael.
Hello.
And ladies last today, I guess. Lisa Schmeiser.
I'm no lady. I'm a podcaster.
There you go. Save the best for last.
That's indeed. My best friend tells her kids, you know, her two daughters to sit and act like ladies. And the older of the two is like, I'm not a lady. I have no desire to be a lady. Mm. And so she had to revise the way she told them to sit down and be quiet because because she's just having none of it.
I get a kick actually out of calling my daughter's friends ladies and gentlemen if I have to address, if they're trampling through the house like wild elephants, it's ladies, ladies, or gentlemen, knock it off. And they, I think they get a kick out of it too, because it kind of reminds them to, you know, pull up and get their manners going.
Nice.
But no, I can't even imagine like the look I would get if I was like, all right, behave ladylike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not going to happen.
No. Are you, any of you familiar with Free to Be You and Me?
No,
I am not.
So back at, oh God, this is where I'm so much older than all of you. So Marlo Thomas, back in like the late 70s, did this program called Free to Be You and Me, which is like a combination of like puppets and cartoons and sketches and songs. That's very hippie and very like 1970s feminist. And it is awesome. I think you can get like the DVD set on Amazon. And one of the sketches is actually this horrible, prissy little girl with golden curls and a pink dress with a big bow. And her big thing was going, ladies first, ladies first. And so she would just be insufferable to people by barging in front of lines, ladies first, ladies first. And the cartoon sketch ends with her like barging to the front of a line going, ladies first. And it turns out the line is a line of people getting ready to be eaten by a crocodile.
I remember that.
Goodness. Yeah. And yeah. So that is what I always think of with ladies first, ladies first.
Wow. Yeah. All right. I know, morbid. To be at the back of the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So ladies first. But anyway, Free to Be You and Me. Completely awesome.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so we watched the last 5 episodes of Jessica Jones season 1 in preparation for the show. What are your overall thoughts?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts, as I assume everyone does. Overall, it was quite the ride, and I'm happy I went on that ride, and I am very much looking for more and excited about more. As a person who had not read any of the comics or had any knowledge of this going into it, this show was a lot of fun. I really got to learn the characters for the first time and try and figure out who everyone is. And you know, a lot of the twists and turns along the way that end up kind of setting up multiple storylines for different shows that Marvel might be working on. That was a lot of fun to kind of be on that ride as well. So I'm just looking forward to more, frankly.
Yeah, I kind of thought I was lost for a couple of episodes. I kind of felt like the season could have been shorter. I felt like there could have been like 10 episodes instead of 13 because they went on so many tangents, kind of, I think, laying the groundwork for these other things. So like all of the Simpsons stuff, I was like, okay, this is weird. And it's just kind of left hanging. And so I don't know. I spent a couple episodes just looking at my phone instead of watching the shows and, you know, kind of like vaguely paying attention to what was going on, because it just seemed so drawn out to me.
They could. You're right. On the one hand, I'm glad because, hey, I love the show. But on the other hand, they could have tightened up a lot of the plot lines. I agree with you that the Simpsons stuff, I feel like they could have benefited from moving up the timeline of that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And this way, because that plot line does two things. One, it demonstrates Simpson could have really benefited from that support group. But
right.
But, you know, like the overall arc of his characterization, I thought, okay, this is somebody who is as much a victim as Jessica is in the sense that somebody hijacked his mind and made him do things he didn't want to do. And he doesn't handle the violation well.
And he does not, no.
No, and like he never actually overtly talks about it, but everything he does in reaction to Kilgrave is basically, this man violated me and I need to get that back. And what I found interesting is the way his story informs Trish's, because at the beginning you see her, she's doing the Krav Maga and she's trying to build herself up. And by the end of it, you can argue that this story is as much about Trish actually on a heroic journey arc, because by the end of it, you know, she's, you know, she saved Jessica as much as Jessica saved her. She's tough. She's had her own brawls. And she's in a much different place than when she started at the beginning of the show. So there is that. That said, though, not a huge fan of the whole pill popping red, white and blue. We have a government program, because part of me is like, exactly how many secret government programs can the Marvelverse support? Like,
a lot, apparently. Right.
Like, what is the economic structure of this Earth? Because like a lot of money is being diverted to programs nobody knows anything about. Like, there's no income, there's no transparent economy. Like, their military budget must just be a nightmare of misdirection between S.H.I.E.L.D. and this and whatever else they've got going on. You know.
So, yeah, and I was confused because I'm assuming that this is a setup for, you know, the shows over the next year or so. But I was like, oh, there's suddenly this doctor and oh, Simpson was like special ops and some kind of secret thing, but it's not really described really well. And, you know, and it seems poorly managed because, you know, he's laying in this hospital bed and he's like, I want another red pill. And the doctor's like, no, but here's a whole bottle.
Right.
And I was like,
yeah,
how did that happen? Well, this is where I really feel like, I feel like this show was a little too subtle in this aspect, because you get the one shot of the child dressed as Captain America running across the park, and that's, oh, look, we're in the same universe. And then you have this guy who, again, has basically styled his hair like Captain America, gone into a government program where he can run in as a super squad, a la Steve Rogers and the, what were they called?
Like, Howling Commandos.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. I'm having like aphasia. Like Steve Rogers and the Howling Commandos. Like, it's clear that in Simpson's mind there's this parallel, and there's the government doctors. And I would have liked to. I would have been really gratified if either Simpson was like, all I ever wanted to do was be like Steve Rogers, or if a government doctor had been like, well, we're trying to create the next generation of Steve Rogers, because it's obvious that this is where. Like, or it seems like it should be obvious that this is what's going on, that like generation after generation of young men gets recruited and turned into science experiments because they're inspired by patriotism and Captain America. And it's obvious that the military is like, we had lightning in a bottle and we totally need to recreate that, because we can't have just one quasi-immortal super soldier running around. And it would have been nice if that had been made more clear. But on the other hand, then you could argue that you can just lift that subplot right out of Jessica Jones, because it should have no place in a TV show that is very much about one woman trying to recover from a hideous experience without much in the way of a support network or psychological health or tools or anything like that. Like, that's basically the Jessica Jones story, is Jessica Jones, not an ideal victim, trying her best anyway, not sure how to go about it. And this whole, we're trying to create Captain America side program thing. Like, hooray. I'm glad it ties into the larger Marvelverse. I'm not sure we need to see as much as we did.
Yep. I agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's actually dead on. So I should be clear too. You know, while I got excited and am looking forward to all of these different shows, taken on its own, it seemed so out of place, especially whenever you consider that it really had no bearing on the outcome. There was no kind of plot device that happened within the Will Simpson episodes that really had any effect on the end, because Trish didn't, I mean, because at one point she takes one of these pills to kind of stop Will Simpson, but, you know, she doesn't end up needing to use a pill to, I don't know, stop Kilgrave, or there's really, other than just showing again how close Jessica and Trish are by having the scene where Trish's, as she was warned, she took a pill and she was told that if she did, then her brain would stop telling her lungs to breathe. And so she ended up passing out, and you know, you had this very powerful scene where Jessica is riding in the ambulance right over her and hoping that she'll start breathing again. But truly, yeah, this it did seem out of place. And Aline, I gotta agree with you. These were the parts where the phone may have creeped out and was in front of my face a few times. So yeah, while I liked it, and I'm excited to kind of see how, again, this plays on the whole Marvel universe. Indeed, it is like, well, you know, if we took this out, it would change nothing else, because we almost just did this weird aside that had no other than to give, I guess, Kilgrave some time to, you know, get more powerful or whatever. There was no real purpose for this.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess Simpson sets up like the torture chamber for them, which hooray, handy to know that your boyfriend has those skills. And and there was like a really it was very striking. It was like one of the last scenes of him where he's on the other side of Trish's door trying to talk to her. And I was struck by how much that mirrored the initial interaction they had when they were on either side of the door talking to each other. And I was like, oh, wow, it really has come full circle. And, you know, he's a tragic figure. It's a sad story. I kind of wish they had done it as like a series of webisodes, like where Trish is tied into it, but it's not distracting from the momentum of the narrative flow. Because you're right, that does distract. And the other thing that kind of distracts is Robin being an agent of chaos for three episodes, a very loud agent of chaos for like three episodes.
Yeah.
And poor Malcolm having his hands full with her. I can see what the writers were trying to do. They're like, okay, we need to establish Trish's forward trajectory as a hero, where she continues to be self-sacrificing, where she gets tougher, and she learns some hard lessons about trust, because those are all things that happen. And we need to establish that at his core, Malcolm is somebody who likes people and wants to help them. Like, he responds to that. This is who he is. So he can do that, and we can establish that these are the character beats that we're going to hit with him. But, like, you know, I went back and rewatched all of the episodes except Sinbin. I couldn't handle watching that one a second time. I went back and rewatched, and you're like, Robin is just still like turned up to 15, and you're just like, oh my God. Please, you know.
Yeah, all the stuff with Simpson, like, we skimmed through the last five in preparation for the podcast again, and I was struck by how much of the Simpson stuff I had just forgotten about, because it was just forgettable. It's like, oh yeah, he comes in here and he does all this stuff and they have this big fight and none of it matters. It's all inconsequential. And yeah, I love the webisode idea for that. I mean, you know, it's on Netflix. I guess it's kind of one big webisode anyway, but yeah, it would have been so much better that way.
I can't remember if it's the original Avengers movie or something that ties into it, but there's like a 10 to 14 minute spinoff they make where Lizzie Kaplan and some dude whose name I can't remember play would-be bank robbers who end up with some Chitauri tech, and they actually get recruited into S.H.I.E.L.D. like as a result of the stuff that they do. And it was basically a one-off, and it's like a DVD special or something like that. And like the Simpsons stuff kind of has that feel to it too, where if it were completely separate and lifted out, you'd be like, oh, hey, it's Patsy. And, oh, wow, that's Patsy. or what have you. But, you know, aside from, again, he does stuff that's like narratively important with he creates the torture chamber. But, you know, beyond that, it feels like, oh, okay, here's the legwork we have to do because we're going to be spinning off, you know, stuff that will come back in The Defenders, or Luke Cage will run across these dudes later, or something like that.
Yep.
So, yeah, I agree with Ruby. You could have edited a lot of that down. Similarly, I had the same feeling about Trish's mom. Like,
Yeah.
I realize they're setting us up for what will probably be the season two story arc, which is Jessica finds out who made her this way. And was it really an accident or was it on purpose? And will she rage some more against the system? Blah, blah, blah. But like you get the creepy interaction in the hospital, and then you get the flashback where Patsy's mom is trying to force her to throw up, and then there's the stuff at the end. And I was like, I feel like it just kind of like, we get that you're laying the groundwork, but it distracted from like some really vital and interesting stuff that was going on. Like, you know, Jerry's personal life going to complete hell and Jessica hurtling towards this final confrontation and Luke Cage being manipulated by everything.
I did think that it served well because there were, you know, there was allusion at the beginning of the series about, you know, how Trish was like divorced from her mom. And, you know, there was kind of some hints about abuse. And so we got to see that. We got to see a little bit of Jessica's origin story with that, or like her discovery of her super strength anyway. And also like, I kind of feel like we got a glimpse of what a master manipulator she is. And so I'm wondering how that might come into play later. So I thought those were interesting elements. But yeah, I'm not sure that it was the best time for them.
Yeah. Plus Trish has been through rehab. Like, we know that she's sober because there have been references to stuff that she's no longer using.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like here and there, they've never explicitly addressed it. No, thank God we haven't had any flashbacks where she passed to play zonked out of her mind or anything like that.
Right.
But like, I wonder how much of next season will be Trish going off the rails or Trish digging into something that she did that. And I'm not sure what it says for the show where I'm like, okay, what's going on next year already when there's still a lot to digest with this season.
Yeah. Let's talk about some good stuff. Some of my favorite scenes were in these last five episodes. One of them was when Luke flashes back and tells Jessica about what happened with Kilgrave, and like that initial flashback where Luke runs up to Kilgrave and Kilgrave just in the nick of time turns around and he's like, stop. And like that whole sequence right there was great. It was so great.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I think I don't know. I'm getting frustrated thinking about all of this because of the way that we were so tricked during this whole thing. And we are seeing Kilgrave take control of Luke. And we're kind of, or at least for me, I was going, okay, you know, please just hurry up through the scene because I need to see what all he says to Luke. I need to know what's going on here. What's being programmed, what's not. And I'm just sitting here hoping that he doesn't say something that ends up working against Jessica. And so then you see the whole scene, or you think you do at least, and it you know, you never see anything. He doesn't know that Luke is super powered, and he doesn't say like, go kill Jessica. And so what we know is, or what we think we know, is that he was supposed to light his bar on fire and blow up. And so, yeah, that's just, I don't know, that the whole thing, whenever we realize later on that there was more control taking place, is like, no.
Yeah. It was a good twist.
It was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you could just, oh, it was devastating. You know, because he says all the right things at first, and then you find out Kilgrave has been scripting all of it. And it was just so, it was such a gut punch. And then he disappears in episode 13.
Yeah, and they don't resolve it. You know,
no.
They leave it hanging wide open. It's like, you have no idea how he feels about her. You have no idea what he's thinking, because, you know, he was under Kilgrave's control right up until the moment when he got shot. And then we have that brief, you know, scene with the nurse and them talking, and that's it. That's it. It's over.
Oh, Rosario Dawson. She's so great.
Isn't she amazing?
Oh, my God. Yeah. And I have to say, I have gone through Daredevil much more slowly than I have through this one. But I love her on Daredevil, and she's just, my hope is that she ends up just popping up in all of the Hell's Kitchen series as kind of the common thread. but she was so good at playing this weary nurse who, you know, her hair has secrets.
Great.
And, you know, she's just, you can see that she's going to be putting pieces together and just kind of trying to chew over the information. And one of the things, the sequel to Alias Jessica Jones, as it were, is in the comics is The Pulse, which is the experiment that Marvel did where Jessica Jones goes to work for J. Jonah Jameson while she's, you know, knocked up with Luke Cage's kid. Again, this is the comic books. They're going to be, the series is 10 years old. You know, you're spoiled by this point. But when Jessica finally gives birth, she actually gets kicked out of the hospital mid-labor because the doctor and the nurses are like, we do not deal with superpowered people. We do not deal with mutants. We have no idea what you're going to spawn in. We can't risk the other patients. And so Jessica ends up like basically having to go to Doctor Strange. And and the thing that it brings up though is that medical care is going to be an issue for people like Luke Cage who can't go to the doctor, or for people like Jessica who have a slightly accelerated healing factor. So like, you know, she's going to react to stuff, how she's going to metabolize medication differently. And I hope that Gail, who is that's the name of Rosario Dawson's character, right?
I could not remember.
I'm pretty sure it's Gail. My hope is that Gail kind of quietly ends up developing this expertise in this triage system and kind of becomes the center of a new medical hub.
That would be neat.
Like, I hope that's how they build out her character and, you know, give her an excuse to do stuff in all of the Marvel series.
That would be interesting.
To follow up on that, her name's Claire.
Oh, Claire. Thank you. Okay.
Claire. Yeah. Claire. But that scene where she's like, I literally have no idea how to help him except this one way. So hold his head still while yes. I jam a needle into his ocular nerve.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. I was cringing so much. And you know, all the fluid that she had to remove from the brain to reduce the swelling. I'm like, that is so gross. But I knew, you know, if anyone can do it, it's Jessica, because your strength would have to just outweigh. It's like, let me just put a bunch of strength on this guy's head because mm-hmm. I can't look at this and I can't tremble. So oof.
Oh god, that was just a great episode. I mean, I we should talk about the final episode as a whole, but I kind of want to talk about the Jerry story arc to me.
Yeah.
Because holy crap. And it was really interesting. Like, I loved how it ended, because you could tell that, you know, her ego and her arrogance were kind of what basically got them into the situation. But like, there was one beat of heartbreak when, you know, Kilgrave's like, find me a doctor, find me someone you trust. And she goes right back to her ex-wife or her soon to be ex-wife.
Yeah.
And like, which she's doing under compulsion. So it's not even mm-hmm. a medical professional. She goes straight to her soon to be ex-wife. So there's that beat. And, I'm still not sure how I feel about the way it all falls apart for her subsequent to the thousand cuts scene, where to exposit Wendy's cleaning up Kilgrave, she and Kilgrave inadvertently like bond as much as Kilgrave's going to bond with anybody, carping about how awful their exes are. Like, and Kilgrave is just talking about all of the ways that Jessica has, yeah, she's terrible, she never appreciates me. And Wendy's like, I went to Paris with her for our 10-year anniversary, and she was on the phone with the client the whole time. And, you know, Wendy mentions that, you know, and Kilgrave's like, you want revenge. And Wendy's like, how do you get revenge for somebody who's, you know, death by a thousand cuts? And when Kilgrave gets hustled out the door, he's like, oh, kill her with a thousand cuts. And so Kilgrave goes to attack Jerry with a scalpel. And it's like a fascinating and horrific scene, because you just find like, this is a woman who's like, oh, okay, I don't really need an excuse to do this, but hey, I have one, I'm going to go at it. And I thought, wow, you know, you can tell she's a medical professional, because her first 20 odd cuts were not meant to kill. They were just meant to inflict a little bit of pain and then escalate. And long story short, Pam walks in on the middle of this, takes a statue and kills Wendy, like basically just whap. And then Wendy falls and her head
onto a glass table.
Yeah, it's just, oh.
Into the corner of a glass table.
Into the corner of a glass table, which makes, you know, because I think what Pam probably meant to do was just take Wendy out, like knock her out. And what she ends up doing instead is inadvertently killing her. And like, what is stunning is What really surprised me is how once Pam was taken into custody, like she turns on Jerry in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And like, she's like, who?
It was so fast.
It was weird because I'm like, you know who she is. You've listened in on all of her calls. How is this a surprise to you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it didn't feel entirely organic to me. Like it felt like a weird contrivance. Like somehow Jerry had to be punished more for setting the situation into motion. Because she's like, I don't know this woman at all. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You've been living in her back pocket for God knows how long, you know.
And it kind of flew in the face of what she had originally said, because remember, she was saying, you're powerful and you take what you want, so go take what you want. And then suddenly it's like, well, you took what you wanted in the way that you would do it. And now I don't know you. No, Pam, I don't believe that.
Yeah, no, like unless Pam is playing Jerry at this point, it just seemed right. Really weird and out of character for her.
I don't, how did Pam get there? Like, why did Pam show up? That's the thing that I missed something, or that wasn't explained, or I don't know, but it was weird.
She said she'd been calling Jerry, right?
Yeah. Didn't Kilgrave have, the lawyer call her?
I don't know. This was one of the episodes where I was like, it's not really that interesting to me.
So Pam, of course, is in a relationship with Jerry, and Jerry had been with Kilgrave, and Pam was calling Jerry over and over again, and Jerry was not answering or talking to her because Kilgrave had her control, that according to what Pam was saying. And so then she was like, I had no idea what happened to Jerry. I thought you might be in a fight with Wendy or something. So I came to your house to the house to check it out. So that was what the writers had decided was the reason why. It's like, well, maybe Jerry's over fighting with Wendy, so I'm going to go over to Wendy's and see if she's there.
Okay. Well, okay.
Right.
Yeah, so there's that, but I kind of think I've read it as a, like, I don't know, like she wanted to punish Jerry, or I don't know. I didn't read it as a genuine statement. I read it as a, like, I'll say anything I can say to get you out of here right now.
Yeah, I think what they were trying to do was, you know, have Pam come off at the end as someone who was really upset, not because they didn't know that Jerry was capable of doing this, but because Jerry did this to her.
Mm, yeah, and that's the distinction I think I was looking for.
Yeah, and I don't think they pulled it off. I don't think they executed well on it because, you know, like you said, you know, the comments she was making weren't entirely in line with that. And I think they could have handled it better. And, you know, I don't know.
I agree with your take. It makes a little bit more sense where maybe Pam isn't horrified by Jerry so much as she's horrified by the fact that. Well, maybe, all right, there's that whole frog and scorpion story where, you know what I was, right? And
right.
Like, Jerry immediately turns on the defense attorney mentality and begins parsing to cover her own ass,
right.
frankly. And Pam is horrified that Jerry would think this way as opposed to being grateful for everything. And maybe that's why she was just like, oh my God, I don't know you. Because she assumed that because they were in love, Jerry would somehow act differently. But part of my brain is like, you saw how this woman treated Wendy. Like, how somebody treats the person they're breaking up with is actually a pretty fair indication of how they're going to treat you at your relationship's
some point, right.
At your relationship's low ebb. So pay attention. And so, and the thing is Pam had come off as very smart and very savvy. So the fact that she was either too love struck to avoid paying attention or too arrogant, like, I don't think either of those possibilities were ever fully sketched in, because Pam always seemed like a woman in control of the situation and a woman who had a great read on Jerry. Like that scene in The Office where she semi-seduces Jerry to get her to do what it takes to get the divorce in, you know, mm-hmm. Like that suggests somebody who's capable of manipulating Jerry and is therefore dangerous. Then all of a sudden we go to this woman who's shocked by what she's done. That said, I guess that scene had to happen so that in episode 13, when Jerry is talking to the prosecutor about why Jessica killed Kilgrave or was compelled to kill Kilgrave, and she spins this really plausible story, you can tell she's talking about herself. And like the acting that she and Kristen Ritter, like the acting that Carrie Ann Moss and Kristen Ritter do in that scene where she is spinning the story about how Kilgrave asked Jessica to kill him because he was really sorry for what he had done and the damage he had caused. And it's unbelievable, but true. And like the way Kristen Ritter just keeps reacting, and you can tell that she's ready to say, like, you can tell that she's weighing whether or not she should say something. Like, just watch mm-hmm. her face the whole time and how she reacts, and how Jerry doesn't even look at Jessica, but you can tell she's kind of communicating psychically, "I'll keep your mouth shut."
Right. Like,
and then the fact that when they go in the parking lot, they part without a word. Like, they just give each other these long agonized looks. Like, you had to get Jerry to that point. And I guess having Pam be all, "I don't know you, I'm going to dump you," you know, like, I guess that's what they had to do. But that's the problem with these last episodes, is you can kind of tell, like, all of the, we have to get to this point in the final episode, so let's backfill in all the emotional beats we have to take to get there.
Yeah, and Pam's not a developed character either, right? Like, we know Pam in the context of her relationship with Jerry. That is the entirety of who Pam is. And I think that's also part of what makes it hard to believe, is because it's like, we don't know. Like, maybe there's some elaborate backstory about Pam where this makes a lot more sense than it does. But for the purposes of what we've seen so far anyway, Pam exists to be Jerry's, I don't know, toy. Like, I don't even, it trophy. Doesn't even feel like, right, it's not like a love interest. I never get the sense from Jerry that she likes Pam for being Pam. There's something else there.
I think she likes the way Pam feels about her more than she likes Pam herself.
That might be it.
No, it's like they say, there's the fantastic 1930s movie The Women, where basically one character spikes her marriage because her husband has an affair. And at one point, the protagonist's mother says, "He didn't have an affair because of you. He just wanted to see himself through somebody else's eyes." And like, everything about the Jerry Pam relationship seemed that way, where they just, Jerry wanted to see herself through Pam's eyes as opposed to Wendy's eyes, where Wendy has years of, you know, seeing Jerry at her worst and sticking with her anyway, whereas Pam is just pure hero worship and, "You're so powerful, you're so this, you're so that." And Pam wanted the power and prestige that comes with having an older, more powerful partner. So, you know, they didn't really know each other. Here we are running down fictitious characters' relationships. You don't know each other.
I thought it was really, so we get to meet Kilgrave's parents. Like, all this time, I've made the assumption they were like dead, or, you know, like maybe he didn't actually have parents, you know, like maybe he was just like a lab child and there were some random people who were called the parents. And but Jessica figures out who his mother is, finds her. Turns out that she's in the city, finds mother and father, brings them to Kilgrave in the tricked out bunker. And so we get this story where Kilgrave's saying, "Oh, they were abusive and experimenting on me." And his parents are saying, "Well, he was going to die, and we were trying to figure out a way to make that not happen." And then it got to a point where we just had to leave. So what do you think about that?
Well, I want to say, you know, with that scene, I felt kind of bad, but at the same time, I was thrilled with how, I guess, this whole series has had an effect, because even after they said what they said, for the longest time, I just didn't believe them. I didn't trust that. I thought there was going to be some weird thing where they had this power too or something. And then whenever they linked up with Kilgrave, then it was, because again, I'm approaching this from not having any, you know, back knowledge based on comics or anything like that. And so I'm going, should I trust these parents? Like, maybe they aren't good people and they really were experimenting on him and being terrible people. But I don't know what happens if they get in the same room. So this whole time, you know, I'm kind of freaking out. And then finally, either the mom or the dad said or did something that it was just like, oh no, this is real. They're telling the truth. And I mean, that's that's some great acting, frankly. And I thought that that was, I don't know, the parents, I think, did a really good job, especially the mom. The dad kind of, at least at first, seemed kind of in the background. But, you know, it was the mom who was like, we need to take responsibility for our child, and whatever it takes to get this done, I'm going to make that happen. And I think, you know, when she realizes that Jessica is a gifted human, then she's like, okay, you know, because I kind of wondered there for a second, okay, you're going to the support group and you're just kind of existing on the edge of things. Why aren't you doing more to help to try to stop your son if you feel responsible for him? But I think that, you know, that is a daunting task, especially if half of your face is scarred because of something that your son did. And so when she sees, oh, well, we've got this powered human who could potentially help us, and it looks like, you know, she's really in it to win it. So that's when it seemed like they were both convinced that this is something we really have to do, and now we have the means to make it happen.
And then they die.
And then they
horribly.
Die.
Oh.
Horribly.
Well, it, so it makes a lot of sense though, why Kilgrave is so, well, there are two things about Kilgrave's brand of torture that I have always found particularly dehumanizing and awful. And one is his utter indifference to other people's bodily functions. Because if you remember in the very first episode, when Jessica finds Hope in bed and she's like, he told you not to move, right? And Hope whimpers, I wet myself. Mm-hmm. And then in episode two, Kilgrave tells the children, I believe children should be seen and not heard. It's like episode two or three. I can't remember which one. And the older girl says, I have to go to the bathroom. And Kilgrave says very coldly, go in the closet. And then like, you just see a little puddle spreading out later. And then there's, in the back stretch of episodes, Jessica's like, the people are going to stink because when they work for Kilgrave, they're on the clock 24/7. They don't get bathroom breaks. They get nothing. And so there's that. And then there were a lot of things that he did to people where there's the guy who left his baby crying by the side of the road. Again, there's the parents who are forced to host Kilgrave while their children are locked in a closet and they're apparently quote unquote fine with this. There's him hijacking children and using them. And he really loves to put people in infantilizing and humiliating positions. And he loves to he loves to attach an intense sense of violation to the rupturing of the parent-child bond. And when you meet him, when you see him interacting with his parents, like, you totally get where this all comes from. Like, he's basically acting out these repressed traumas from when he was a child, and he's inflicting them on other people because he's so angry about what was done to him.
He's a petulant man-child, basically. Like, what they did really well is the stunting of emotional development at the preteen age, where it's like, you know, because that's really the point in time, put on my early childhood hat, that's really the time when people start to realize, like, really realize that other people have feelings and emotions outside of you. You know, that's when that all starts to happen. And he never got that development, whether that was because his parents left or, you know, maybe a side effect of the experimentation or whatever. But he is stuck in like this preteen state where it's all about him. And if he doesn't get his way, then, you know, the world is ending and everything has to be perfect. And it doesn't matter what anyone else might think or feel or need, because he is 11 years old.
I want to call out David Tennant's just superb performance throughout the whole series. Like, there was never a single second at which I was like, you know, he didn't nail every single scene, every single interaction.
He's got an amazing line.
Yeah, he does.
He makes such a great abuser. But the reason he makes such a great abuser is, as anybody who works with it will point out, abusers are not abusive 24/7. If they were, they would never have victims.
Right.
Like, he makes a great abuser because he knows how to turn on the charm, how to lightly shrug things off, how to gaslight, how to minimize, how to be casually cruel. Like, he was so committed to the part. There was never any sense of ironic distance or anything like that. And the whole time I was watching him, I was like, oh, I can see where Doctor Who fans would wig out. But like, I was like, he, like, the great thing about him is he plays a monster, but it's not one of these compelling, charismatic monsters. Like, he's no Hannibal Lecter or Dexter or one of those. Like, he full out commits to playing him as just a deplorable human being. And I really appreciate that, because I do get kind of bothered by the charismatic villain type trope where it's, oh, well, sure, Hannibal Lecter kills people and then turns them into bizarre pieces of sushi and so on and so forth, but whoopee, whoopee, whoopee. And like, they don't do that with Kilgrave here. Like, his tragic origin story is so ambiguous that you can read it either way, where one, his parents are mad scientists who experimented on him, or he had a neurological disease, or the truth is somewhere in the middle. Like, you never know. And I appreciate that. And I appreciated how they, like, he pulled no punches with just pointing out that he's just a terrible character. Boom. It doesn't matter why. What matters is that he is, and that he has no problem doing terrible things to other people to threaten and intimidate people into doing what he wants. Like, think about how he gets his father to, like, that dude who gets killed with the garden shears or kills himself with the garden shears. Like, think about what an effective terror method that was. And I was like, wow, Kilgrave is just straight up pure terrorist. And it's great that they don't shy from this at all.
Yeah, that whole put your hand in the blender.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. Right.
Yeah.
And the way he's so nonchalant about it, too, just drives me up the wall, because he's, but go ahead, do it. Just put your, and then there's that disregard for anyone else's emotions again that you talked about, Aline, because we know the type of fear that one would experience and the type of just, I mean, physical, you know, your heart racing and your, you know, your palms sweating and everything like that. And he's just, you know, oh, no big deal, but not realizing, or probably realizing, but maybe not realizing just how much of an effect that is having on the other person. And that, oh, I that just not giving to, you know what, about everything that he does is so frustrating. And it's one of those, boy, someone needs to teach you a lesson kind of things. And yeah, I think that is the stuck in preteen. I that probably sums him up in way better way than I've heard it elsewhere, because really, you know, if you think about that and you go back and look at the season as a whole, he is this tiny little child just who wants what he wants. And the unfortunate fact is that he, for the most part, 99% of the time gets what he wants, because that's the power that he has. And so when the one thing, you know, for the kid, it's the present that they want at Christmas that they don't get. Well, what do they spend the next year obsessing about is that present that they didn't get for Christmas. And so this, in this case, is, you know, he didn't get Jessica. Jessica got away from him. And so he wants that back, because that is his missed Christmas gift in this long metaphor I'm going with.
Yeah. So why don't we talk about the last, oh, actually, before we do that, talk about the last episode. We did get a little bit of feedback. I was made aware of, in the first episode, we talked about how there weren't any Apple devices. Like, it was implausible. Like, there are no Apple devices. And someone on a forum, which I will link to in the show notes, was talking about how, well, obviously none of these people have ever been to Hell's Kitchen. And I think, Lisa, actually you made the comment about that. And I didn't take it as a, oh, everybody should have an iPhone and everybody should have a Mac and you know, like all of that. But like, maybe Jerry would have an Apple computer because she can kind of afford that. And maybe, you know, there would be an iPhone 5C laying around somewhere, you know, like, I mean, I think all four of us anyway are kind of we're very, not very Apple centric, but we are in an Apple centric community. Let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. But I don't think any of us believes that Apple makes the world go round.
No.
And that everybody everywhere owns a Mac or an iPhone, but like a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So well,
Jessica's got that Android that we see plugged in the last episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I heard Christina say it, if I'm not mistaken, that kind of stuck out for her. And I think really what that is there, of course, that's something that we are looking for, because that's what we kind of do. And especially those of us who delve into tech journalism. And so I think, you know, it's not so much that, oh, how dare Jessica have an Android device? No, it's simply that, you know, not seeing any of them does seem to kind of stand out, because when and no, I don't live in New York, but I imagine I don't live anywhere near these areas. But I imagine in most places, if you look around on the subway or wherever, you're going to see at least one iPhone and, you know, ear pods and that kind of thing. So it seemed out of place, but it's also unimportant to the overall narrative of the story. Yeah. It's just one thing that stuck out. But yeah, I mean, I understand what that person is saying. And for sure, you know, it's not not that I'm upset that, well, why doesn't Jay Jones rep the latest iPhone 6 right? with a new battery case that looks terrible? But that's not what this is about.
Well, you know, she's hit rock bottom when she starts using Windows Mobile.
Oh boy.
I do think that the charger that was delivered that Robin was flipping out about, I'm pretty sure that was an iPhone charger that they threw under the river or the ocean or whatever it was.
Okay. So anyway, I just thought we'd bring that up. And then, so let's talk about that last episode. It really, for me, it was the last few scenes. And the rest of it was kind of like, eh. Well, no, not necessarily, I guess.
Well, I full props to Patsy, though, for her stone cold participation. Because, like, when you watch her, because I heard the metal, I was like, oh, whatever, this is just so freaking macho and cliched and boo his show for going that way.
Right.
But then when you finally realize, you know, Patsy literally put herself into the most vile form of danger possible just so that Jessica could get the jump on Kilgrave. And you think about, like, the guts it had to take for her to do that, you know, because this is somebody who is also a survivor of abuse and a recovering addict. And, like, her friend with benefits went, like, full-blown bonkers on her. Like, for right. her to, you know, be like, okay, this is what we have to do. This is how we commit. Like, this is Patsy coming into her own as a hero. And, like, I was like, oh my gosh, go Patsy with that.
Uh-huh. I did too.
Yeah. So, like, from that point on, it was pretty insanely awesome. That said, I would like the scene with Jerry and Jessica in the jail. What made that final, I guess, the back third of the episode so powerful for me was not how things resolve with Kilgrave, you know, hint, crunchy, snappy, but like
it was all very just
anticlimactic in a way.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
To me that was the point, because the point is this whole season arc, I think, is about Jessica trying to figure out how to recover and doing it poorly, because one, there's no such thing as a perfect victim, and two, there's no such thing as a perfect recovery. And like the fact that Jessica manages to get to a place with Patsy where, like, there is no doubt how the two of them feel about each other. Like, they have each other's backs, and it's 100%, and they're both in it to win it, and they're making each other better people in their own weird ways. Like, to me, that was gratifying to see how that played out and was reinforced. The fact that Jessica and Jerry have this very complicated relationship, which where Jessica's like, Jessica calls her vile names and says, now go get your partnership, you deserve it. And like, she gives Jerry a pep talk. And in return, Jerry like brings it 200% when Jessica's on the hook for murder. And the resolution of that relationship over the course of the story arc was incredibly gratifying. And then to have Malcolm step up and like begin to act as her in-house assistant, like, for me, the fact that Jessica now basically has built ties to these people, whether or not she wanted them, she's got these healthy, positive ties that she figured out how to make. Like, for me, that was the point. Like, reckoning with her abuser and wiping him off the face of the planet, I think, you know, sure, like, in the grand narrative tradition, that's supposed to be the big deal. But no, the big deal is that Jessica managed to survive. She did the right thing. And she's figuring out a way to move forward. Like, even if she feels crappy about it because she was forced to kill somebody, like, the truth of the matter is that she did the hard stuff, and the even harder stuff for her is making relationships. And she did that too.
Yeah. And this actually ties really well into the article on feministfrequency.com that Anita Sarkeesian wrote about Jessica Jones and her criticism of the show. And a lot of it was like, well, Jessica's not going to a support group and she's not modeling, you know, good behavior. And I was pretty frustrated with this article in a lot of places. I thought there were a lot of good points, but like, further undermining the show's handling of trauma recovery is the fact that blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's, the show isn't about healthy trauma recovery. I don't think anyone is arguing that, you know, Jessica maybe should not drink ever again, or, you know,
or hop into bed with hot yet inappropriate men. Yeah.
Right. You know, I
don't think there's any perfect victims. I don't think you should be prescriptive about recovery either, because that just puts pressure on a situation that's already super fraught. Like, there are really unhealthy coping skills, and you can call those out and say, this is perhaps not working for you. But at the same time, like, people are also different. And people have their own histories and their backstories and their goals that they bring into it. To finger point with, this is how you need to recover. If you're not recovering well, then I don't think it's useful. I can see where there's good intentions, but I'm not sure that's an idea that is necessarily constructive to a wider conversation, if that makes sense. Because if you have somebody who's already struggling with trauma and recovering from trauma and moving past it, to be told, recovery, you're not doing it right, like, how is that helpful?
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Right. Absolutely.
And again, I want to stress, there are people who do, you know, really engage in unhealthy coping behaviors and stuff like that too. But maybe the whole point to this is that when people show you grace when you least deserve it, and when people show you compassion when you are doing dumb and self-destructive things, like, maybe it's the behavior that people show to you that ultimately helps you figure out your own path out of it. Cause that's what helped Jessica dig out, is the fact that Malcolm, like, once he got out of his Kilgrave /Smackfog, like, Malcolm immediately begins rebuilding his identity and his sense of self one step at a time. And he's compassionate towards Jessica and watches out for her. And she in turn gets something from that. And the same goes for Trish, and the same in a weird way goes for Jerry. And so this is why, you know, Jessica begins to claw her way out in the back few episodes.
There are two main things that kind of come out of what you've just said, for me at least, is, you know, a lot of people, myself included, will find themselves relating to characters in different shows, movies, cartoons, what have you. And you can kind of use those things to, in some instances, you can use those, the relation that you see with this person, to help inform what you should or shouldn't do. And I think in this case, you know, if Jessica were to play the perfect recoverer, then that almost gives the impression that someone who is working to recover, but continues to find some, you know, some bad ways of making or coping with that recovery, then if they never see an example of, well, in the end, they were able to do the right thing and step away from the bad coping or what have you. If you never see the examples that are more realistic, then you don't have anyone to kind of show that, okay, you know, I don't want to get so down on myself because I'm doing this the wrong way. It is possible to come out of this. It is possible to be successful. And so if everything we see is this perfect shining example, it doesn't reflect real life, and it can be difficult for people to find help in things like this. And I think too, you know, while we look at Jessica and see the way that she's coping, and remember too that so many people in the show constantly talk to her about that and say, hey, maybe drinking that whiskey isn't a good idea. But then, yes, we look at Malcolm and we see that he had to do the same thing, and he did go through the normal path, and he did go to the meetings and ended up leading them. And then at the end, they're both right next to each other, and they both have been successful. They both have pulled themselves out. And so it shows that there's more than one path to get there. And I think that that's so important, because if if we don't show diversity in all things, if we only show, again, this one shining perfect example of the way that we think that things should be done, then we're lying to ourselves. And I think we're also doing a disservice to people who don't have that normal experience.
Yeah, but, you know, at the end, you know, Malcolm has pulled himself out, but Jessica's still mired in a lot of it. And, you know, I think it would have been problematic if at the end, you know, after killing Kilgrave and, you know, having resolution to a lot of these things, you know, everything was sunshine and rainbows. I think that would have been a horrible way to handle it, especially for Jessica. But they didn't do that. Like, you know, we didn't spend a whole lot of time with her, you know, post Kilgrave death, but we spent enough time to know that she's still drinking heavily. She's still, you know, shutting out a lot of the world, you know, as evidenced by her just starting to delete all those voicemails without even listening to all of them. You know, she's still traumatized and she still has a bunch of stuff to deal with, and killing him didn't resolve anything. And I think that's accurate. And I think it's realistic. And, you know, if they hadn't done that, that would have been problematic. But the fact that they showed all of this realistic stuff from all these different angles, I think it was handled extremely well.
It's also worth pointing out that Malcolm is better equipped to, for resilience and recovery than Jessica is, because, you know, he was training in social work, so he's got some sort of educational or vocational background that's given him tools for handling trauma and recovery. And it was intimated through Facebook and stuff that he does have a really supportive and loving family structure too. And you contrast that with Jessica, who, you know, gets orphaned in circumstances that she blames herself for and is immediately thrown into the lion's den in an abusive household while she's bereaved, while she's been given these powers that she doesn't have. And there's this suggestion that, you know, she really hasn't had a whole lot of resources at all, period. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that she gets adopted by Patsy's mother suggests that there wasn't an extended family to bring to take her in the first place. So she didn't have any strong social ties to begin with. She didn't have, in a lot of ways, she's still stuck in adolescence because that's where the defining trauma of her life came from. And so she doesn't have the same resources Malcolm does, which is why she's a hotter mess than he is because, you know, she got thrown into a grave situation with considerably fewer spoons in her backpack, as it were. So, I mean, and that's part of it too, is again, this goes back to there are no perfect victims. There is no perfect recovery. People have some access to so many different levels of resource. You know, somebody who suffers a sudden bereavement, if that's the only person in their world, recovering from that kind of loss is going to be much, much different than if you suffer from a sudden bereavement, but you have this close-knit group of friends and family who can support you through it and help you through it. And that's something that the show never explicitly calls out. But since there is a big case to be made for human connection all the way through, you know, maybe that's something you're supposed to pick up on further viewing, is the people who tend to recover better are the ones who do recognize the need for social ties and bring that out. And for whatever reason, Jessica's not there.
Lisa, I got to say real quick that I love that you said that Jessica was thrown into a grave situation.
Oh, yeah. Womp womp.
Bravo.
Yeah, and that ties into one of the things that I've been thinking, which is I think in a lot of cases, like, recovery needs to be modeled, you know, like, I don't know, like, you know, going back to her loving supportive family died and then she's suddenly thrust into this awful situation when she has all of this guilt, when she's, you know, bereaved, and like she just doesn't know. And I think a lot of people don't know that there are resources available to help. And, you know, like, people cope with alcohol all the time. And so, yeah, I think it was realistic. And I think it would be, frankly, all of the other things that you've pointed out aside, it would be boring if this was like, oh, let's follow Jessica Jones as she goes to group therapy. And let's follow Jessica Jones as she goes to her one-on-one therapy session. And let's, well, you know, she's found a therapist who believes her. So let's talk about confronting her abuser and how that would go. And I mean, that's bad TV. Like all of those other things about, you know, people needing to see flawed characters aside, like, yeah.
Well, let's face it. Nobody watches Tony Stark because he's healthy and well-adjusted.
Right.
I mean, and that's actually kind of a theme through most of the Marvelverse, to be frank, is there is like, either there are no therapists anywhere on that world, or people are, or there's like no mental health advocacy or anything like
Well, all of those type of people are taught how to experiment on children.
I guess so. Like, maybe that's like the prevailing, like there is no APA. There's just... I'm sorry. I'm just now imagining this horrible, like Freud never existed. There was never any psychotherapy, but like, that's actually kind of a common trope through the entire Marvel universe is that the people who are driven to these acts of greatness do so because they have these big unresolved traumas that they just cannot handle in appropriate ways. I mean, for God's sake, over on Daredevil, like but that's like the closest thing you've got to like a healthy back and forth. And it's a dude who's talking to his priest about how he wants to kill people. So,
right.
So all of it's just a big hot mess. I think, though, that maybe this is why I liked this show so much, is it does go into and plumb the need for human connection and how that's universal, even if your circumstances are not or your personality is not. Because let's face it, even if Jessica had not been orphaned and thrown into Patsy's orbit and all of that, like temperamentally, she's just a prickly personality, you know?
Yes.
And even under the best of conditions, she was never going to be somebody who was, you know, sweetness and light and merry sunshine and conscientious. And so there's almost an argument to be made that the way she is now is quite possibly a better version of Jessica Jones than the Jessica Jones who would have grown up with the benefits of a stable, loving household, just because this is a Jessica who has to rebuild herself piece by piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting because you do have a woman who is defining herself as opposed to being defined in opposition to a man or by a man.
Thank God.
Yeah. No, I kind of want to see her rolling her eyes at the Avengers in real life, though. Like, it would be so beautiful.
Yes.
Like Scarlet, like Black Widow goes by and Jessica's like a cat suit and rolls her eyes. You know, or like makes some sort of cutting remark that sends the Hulk crying.
Aw, you can't help it.
Yeah. That said, so what I recommend is like a palate cleanser for this, believe it or not, is I also like went on a binge watch of Don't Trust the Bitch in Apartment 23, or Don't Trust the B, as it was for network television, where Kristen Ritter is, you know, the titular B, and she's such a different character. It's so much fun, and it's just such a light, fluffy palate cleanser after this, where, you know.
I haven't even heard
in
of
that
it.
One, she,
I'm going to need to do that.
Oh, my God. Okay, it's on Netflix. It was... a low-rated but hilarious sitcom on ABC for 2 years. And the premise is that she plays a girl named Chloe, who's a party girl and a total Manhattan nightmare, and also the best friend of actor James Vanderbeek. And James Vanderbeek plays himself as James Vanderbeek actor in this, and he's super hilarious. And basically every week, Chloe has different awful schemes. And her sweet, good-natured, straight-from-Indiana roommate gets like swept up in stuff like this. And it's on Netflix. It's super funny. And Kristen Ritter plays somebody who's just this unrepentant hedonist and very funny and casual. And it's great. Like her life idol is Charo. And she's, you know, someone's like, oh, Charo is her Barbara Streisand. And she's like, no. And anyway, it's totally worth watching. Great palate cleanser after Jessica Jones.
I need to do that because I have had several friends now recommend that show. So,
Funny.
Clearly that's a good way. That's like a true palate cleanser because you've got the same character and it's like, okay, so yay, not so torn up in this one. That's good.
Yeah. Oh, it's so great. And it points out that Kristen Ritter really is doing a great job with the Jessica Jones role. Like there were a lot of really good acting jobs on this where people just like, you're like, oh, done.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
so there is one more aspect of these last five episodes that I want to talk about and get your thoughts on, and that's Hope's sacrifice. So you know, Kilgrave's, you know, set up the scene in the restaurant. He's got the support group, you know, standing up on the bar with all the nooses around their necks, and you know, he wants to make a trade. He wants to trade Hope for his father. And Hope's sitting there obediently because she's been told to. And there's a moment when she has, you know, a little bit of control. And rather than doing what everyone thinks she's going to do, attack Kilgrave or try to run, she stabs herself. She kills herself. And it's very clear that the reason she does that is because she wants Kilgrave to die. And she realizes the only person who has a chance at doing that is Jessica. And Jessica will not do it until she can get Kilgrave to exonerate Hope. Hope realizes that's not going to happen. So she takes herself out of the equation. And I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, that scene and, you know, that decision by that character.
Well, you think about and I can see actually where when I read the Feminist Frequency piece and they talk about Hope, I'm actually kind of grateful we didn't know more about her because it's just such a tragic arc that she had. Like, first she's kidnapped by this terrible abuser. Then she's pregnant by him. Then she's kidnapped by this terrible abuser. She's compelled to kill her parents. She's thrown into jail. She discovers she's pregnant. She ends up having an extremely painful abortion. And she does point out to Jessica when Jessica's fighting to release her. She's like, and Jessica's like, we can put you on a plane back home. And she's like, I really don't have a home. I killed my parents, remember? Like, even if I didn't want to do it, she is the one who murdered them. And from her perspective, perhaps she had the consolation. Like, she was probably miserable and suicidal anyway, because again, victim of prolonged abuse and rape,
mm-hmm.
and inadvertent murderess. So she loses her closest family. She's ostracized by her community back home. Her life here has fallen apart. And perhaps for her, what she was thinking was, my death will have meaning. You know, my death can redeem my actions and it will have meaning because it will compel Jessica to do what she has to do. So yeah. maybe for her, the death was a consolation and a self. I mean, that's what we can hope. Because it was a desperation move on one level where it's like, I have to do this because otherwise Jessica's not going to act. But on another level, it was, if I do this, at least my death has meaning and I can take back some control over this situation that I've been in that was hellish and awful.
Absolutely. That hits the nail on the head, in my opinion. I think, you know, if you consider what the opposite was, which is that she lives and we likely just continue to see the same doggone thing because Jessica is fighting the wrong battle in as far as Hope believes. And so, you know, if she's thinking that, then what is her life? Her life is spending more time in prison. Her life is possibly having to deal with Kilgrave more. Her life is all of these terrible things that she doesn't want. She doesn't want to be controlled. She wants to have she wants to be, you know, herself again, at least is what it seems. And if that's the one way to make it happen, and in the meantime, you're also helping so many other souls, that's, you know, it almost gives meaning to the death of her parents as well, because in that sense, she's stopping anyone else from experiencing the same fate that she did and that her parents did. So it is a selfless and terrifying act, but I think that it's a brave and, frankly, if you just look at the cold hard facts, an all but necessary one.
Yeah, I feel like that scene with her sacrificing herself ties almost directly into the scene at the end on the dock when Jessica is, you know, crossing the dock to approach Kilgrave, and there's two dozen people standing there and he tells them all to start killing each other. And, you know, I feel like if Hope hadn't sacrificed herself, Jessica would have been stopped in her tracks trying to prevent all of those people from killing each other. But instead, because of that pivotal moment, because of the choice she made, because of that sacrifice, Jessica realized, you know, finally realized that he has to be stopped at all costs. And in that case, the cost was some of these people on the dock. And instead of trying to stop and help all these people, she starts to push through them. She starts to, you know, approach him and do what needs to happen. And I thought that, you know, it was all very well crafted as far as motivations and, you know, the motivations for the Jessica's character.
Well, were there any other topics that anyone wanted to bring up?
I did, just that scene still. I know we talked about how what followed was really great, but I have to be honest, there was a lot of excitement in that scene because and the scene I'm talking about is Kilgrave tells everyone to stop and Jessica stops along with everybody mm-hmm. else. And then you kind of wonder, OK, was his father able to engineer some way to make him more powerful and powerful enough to control Jessica again? And he approaches and is so giddy and excited and happy and thrilled that he finally has control over her again and tells her to smile. And she smiles and my stomach turns a little bit. And then we realize that he does not have control over her.
She's
and
just that him.
She's playing him. Finally, the tables have turned completely and fully. And Justin, kind of going off what you said, you know, now he literally has no control over her, none at all, because when he lost control of her with his powers, the way that we saw him take control of her throughout the rest of the series was by using her desire to help everyone else over getting him. And so throughout the whole thing, it's like, well, I'll just put these people in nooses and I will make sure that the police are pointing their guns at each other and all this, whatever it takes to make her stop, because her moral code does not allow for her to not save these people. And so, yeah, Hope kind of released that last bastion of control or last method of control that he had over Jessica, because he just kind of like a sick virus. He adapted and found a new way to take control of her. And she said, not anymore. Like, you have absolutely no control over me. So that was powerful, I think, just in and of itself, to realize that there were no strings left. And then he was gone.
She does refer to herself as a villain at the end of it, though, which I found was really striking. Because it seems to me that the whole point of being a hero is that you make really hard choices, really hard, bad choices, and you live with them. And instead, she's using it as an opportunity to kind of sink into self-loathing. But, like you said, Hope's death was the thing that finally made her realize that sometimes there are no good choices and no real wins.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think she realizes that's what a hero is. I don't think she's to that point yet. I think she still has, you know, an ideal hero complex in her mind that she's not living up to. And, you know, heroes that can do no wrong and always make the right choice and always save the day. And, you know, I think she's starting on the path to realizing that that doesn't exist, that that's an unattainable goal.
Where do you get that? Because my interpretation is, like, I don't think she's trying to be a hero. I think she's trying to stop Kilgrave. And for her, that was one person at a time until she realized that that wasn't possible. So I don't ever get the feeling like there was a point in time where she wanted to be a hero. But now I feel like she's just trying to stop this guy from doing these bad things. And she's putting out fires, right? She's going from one fire to the next until she realizes, like, This is not the way I can do that. Like, I've got to think bigger picture. Yeah, I don't know.
That's fair. There's no point in the end at which you feel like she's trying to continue on and put on the suit that Trish introduced to her whenever they were younger. Because, you know, we can look at her deleting the voicemails in one case as trying to continue to not be connected to others. But in another case, yes, it's also that, you know, she did the thing that she set out to do. And this seems more of a personal thing, a truly personal thing, where this person took control of me. I know what this feels like and I know how terrible it is. I want to stop him. But in the meantime, I'm also going to help all of the other people who were harmed by this person. But once that's done, then that motivation is over. And so it's like, what am I taking these voicemails for? It's kind of like that underlying motivation for everything has left, and the subtle guilt that she may have felt because throughout her life, because she knows that Kilgrave, or well, I guess she didn't know that Kilgrave was still out there, but for some reason, you know, she decided to go into the detective agency and do all of this other stuff. And now it seems like, you know, I've fought the good fight, and maybe I'm going to take a break for a while. And I think that maybe our dear social worker is going to remind her of how important she is and how good she is truly underneath everything. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, that's why I have a feeling he's going to undelete those messages.
Yeah. And I love that ending where it's him on the phone. How can we help?
How can we help you? Yeah, no, I like the idea that by season two, she's verbally abusing him on a regular basis and he's just ignoring it and pushing her towards different clients. That said, I hope that we see her cameo in Luke Cage in some way, shape or form.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
You know, and I also hope that we see more of Claire because I love Claire. So,
also agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, actually, you know what I would really like to see is I'd like to see Jessica and Foggy run across each other from Daredevil. But this is just because I find Foggy to be more interesting than Matt Murdock. So
she would look at him and he would wither. So yeah,
that's why basically he'd do that. And then the nice character played by Deborah Ann Wall, whose name I'm blanking on that name, too. I have terrible name for fictitious characters. But the point is like one of the things that Daredevil does right, and this is not the Daredevil podcast, but one of the things it does right is its women are fantastic. Its women are phenomenal and strong and well-rounded. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see Jessica go up against people who go toe-to-toe with her. Like, that would be great.
Yeah, it would.
Either that or Robin goes on a blind date with Foggy. That could be your tie-in.
Oh no. It's no, the no, 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 no.
Robin, Robin, Robin.
If I never see Robin again, it'll be no. Oh.
Yeah, that I actually, whenever we last spoke, I had not seen the episodes that came after the ones about which we were speaking previously. And so I was talking about Robin based on what I had known so far. And I think for several of you, it was also based in what you would eventually see in these, or mm-hmm. what you did see in these episodes as well, because she just becomes that much worse. And yeah. It even resulted in me tweeting, Robin is the worst, because she is just the worst.
At least they left her. They left everything in a place where it's like she can cleanly be totally forgotten now. She never has to be brought up again. Her threads are, you know, tied up in a nice bow where she can just be done. Please. Pretty please.
Pretty please.
All right.
All right.
All right. This was wonderful.
So that's it for season one. Hopefully we'll be back for season two. I'd like to thank all of the panelists who've been here, Jason Snell, Christina Warren, Micah Sargent.
Yay.
Yay. Lisa Schmeiser.
Yay.
Yay. Justin Michael.
No one's controlling us anymore.
No.
and so, yeah, we'll see you on season two.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.